The precious metals rally continued for the third week running, while the Dow Jones picked up 300 at another 100-year-plus record, over 21,000. Well, welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to rejoin you for a big Memorial Day holiday show where we remember our heroes who valiantly defended our nation over the past 240-odd years. Please join us in a brief moment of silence to honor our comrades in arms and those combat vets behind the scenes who are responsible for our freedoms. Well, thanks to their efforts, we have two new guests this week who join me for engaging discussions on the financial markets, including John Scursi of Corona Capital Management, who makes his show debut. He's convinced the Great Recession credit crisis never ended, that they merely poured trillions of dollars over our debt problems, increasing debt levels by over 60% since the last financial shock, and that could lead to an even bigger problem ahead for investors. He likes the precious metals as a panacea for everyone's portfolio. Then Wall Street legend Peter Grandich rejoins me with a discussion on the cryptocurrencies, the precious metals, and the U.S. markets. We also discuss a stunning Fed statistic. The recent report indicated 44% of Americans have less than $400 in savings for either a car repair or a hospital visit. You know, this is roughly 100 million people just can't afford it without their credit cards or an insurance policy. Plus, we review Michael Snyder's interesting report that shows that GDP growth averaged 1.3% the 10 years before the Great Depression. In the last decade, we've also had 1.3% economic growth, and he questions whether or not we might be on track for something similar. And GoldSeek.com is excited to have a new sponsor here. Major mid-tier producer Silvercorp will be our sponsor for this year. We're excited to have them here. Ticker SVM. They recently announced an increase in their dividend by 35%. Of course, it's a humble dividend, but it's always great to see companies with improving dividend yields over time tend to be the strongest growers in a portfolio. It's really well documented within the peer-reviewed journals. And for transparency's sake here, folks at GoldSeek may or may not be investing in the company. Our top gold stock analyst, Peter Spina, really a wizard when it comes especially to the precious metals sector, expressed interest in adding shares to SVM on a pullback, which he's expecting in the mining sector. And remember, we'd like for you to sign up for my Alpha Stocks newsletter. We captured the recent Bitcoin ETF explosion from under $100 a share. To get this, 600 this week. That's right, in 1 week's time, the GBTC, our favorite Bitcoin ETF, actually rocketed almost 140% in 1 week before pulling back and still having a nice solid move. This has just been one of many, many. We had several stocks just blast higher this week. My two favorite picks, actually. Of course, we're in a bull market, right? Okay, so you can throw darts and win, but for the most part, we're outperforming the market. So if you'd like to bump up your portfolio's profits, why not take a look? And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metal sector as gold blasted through resistance for the third week running. The yellow metal added 15, up 1% at $12.68 an ounce, while silver picked up over 50 cents, 3%, ending at $17.32. The precious metals XAU shares gave back 50 cents, though, but still found solid support under 85. Black gold also pulled back to support by about 1.7%, just less than $50 per barrel. The Fed meeting minutes in May were released on Wednesday, which supported the consensus view that the central bank will hike rates at the upcoming June 14th meeting. Financial markets are currently pricing in an 83% probability of a rate rise then, that according to the CME's Fed Funds Futures tool. However, odds are very low of a second rate hike this year, only about 37% in December, FOMC, also according to the Fed Funds Futures contract. This idea was further corroborated by an article this week in USA Today, where James Bullard, the St. Louis Federal Reserve chief, noted raising rates twice this year may be a bit overly aggressive, and that was music to precious metals aficionados' ears. In related news, geopolitical uncertainty continues to ratchet up with growing concerns over recent rocket launches by officials in North Korea. The U.S. president met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, noting that there's a big problem with North Korea's ambitions for nuclear weapons and that it would be resolved, quote, you can bet on that, according to various media outlets. Moreover, upcoming U.K. elections following the U.K. bombing in Manchester this week, where there were at least 19 fatalities and 50 injuries at a public concert by Ariana Grande. Elsewhere, recent inflation reports indicate numbers in excess of 2.5% over the past 4 months. That was the highest level in about 5 years. So it's little surprise to learn that the total global demand increased 21% year over year, due mostly to investment demand, which surged 122% over the same time frame, the bulk of which stemmed from demand from ETFs that registered a 300% climb. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, from a purely technical vantage point, the action this week continues to confirm my recent thesis that gold and silver are both carving out a highly bullish inverted head and shoulders pattern that should be complete in about a month or so. That would provide the launching pad, I think, necessary for an assault on $1,500 gold and well over 21 to 25 silver. The XAU is on a slightly different trajectory here. The technical position is a little different. The bulls and bears are battling out in a flag pattern between the 50 and 200 week moving averages. Still, I think things look solid for the bulls if they can gain the upper hand. The only proviso here is if the Fed raises rates in June and then the odds start to drop precipitously of another rate hike, I think that could provide everything we need to keep the battered U.S. dollar subdued, offering a chance for the precious metals to climb to the stratosphere. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility also virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange, a best of all worlds style scenario for our listeners. By Friday's close, the Dow Industrial was up 275 points, ending at 20,867, just shy of the 21,000 mark. Also an all-time record weekly close in more than 110 years. The S&P 500 added 34 points, finishing at 2415 for the week, while the NASDAQ Composite picked up 126 points, ending at 6210. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF blasted higher. It started the week under 250 and blasted roughly 140%, just shy of 600, before finishing up 84% at 405 for the week. So 150 points to all my listeners and Alpha Stocks subscribers. With all due humility, you're welcome. And the Komodo ICO was up at 50 cents, just about 20-fold. Meanwhile, investors continue to ignore the lackluster U.S. economic growth numbers. According to government data this week, the U.S. economy experienced meager GDP growth in the first quarter, annualized rate of just less than 0.8%. That's the slowest pace in a year. Traders remain hopeful that the promised corporate tax breaks and incentives will continue to catapult U.S. equities further into uncharted territory. Bottom line on U.S. stocks. Well, despite the record zeniths, seems like nearly daily in the indexes, the 7-indicator greed to fear index suggests few, if any, signs of frothiness. That's right. There's just plenty of room for further upside coming up after the break. More Gold Seek Radio. John Scorsese, partner and portfolio manager, founder of Corona Associates Capital Management, makes his debut on the show.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Read through much of your material, and it looks as though you're concerned that U.S. equities may have reached a zenith here. The markets have gotten ahead of themselves. You're concerned about the regime change, the new administration, and that perhaps investors need to be making contingency plans.
Well, I think, you know, we happen to be, Chris, in one of these truly extraordinary moments in time, and that was really the motivating factor for me to get back into the money management business after a decade-plus hiatus where I did not think the opportunities were going to be particularly interesting. And, you know, what always is forefront in my own mind as an investor is, you know, what are those opportunity subsets? And what I had identified was there was a set of circumstances taking place which was not fully understood or appreciated by the vast majority of people out there. And the primary thing that I think people do not understand or do not fully appreciate is where we are in the history of monetary conditions. Just to kind of draw the clock back a little bit, when I started out as a professional in this business, it was 1981. I was a young recruit out of business school, landing my first job at Morgan Stanley, working in the sales and trading area, the equities area. That particular year, I remember, was the year in which the Dow Jones started with an 8. And that 8 was 800. Interestingly enough, gold was also a number that was very near the same number that the Dow was. My perspective on how I look at everything is what is part of my living memory. And that's another point I wanted to make. We are all creatures of our living memory. And it's interesting to note, you know, how much our perspective has changed in that. For example, I remember, you know, sitting in the trading room, and one of the things that was most on people's minds was what happened at 4:15 on Friday afternoons, which was when the Fed released the so-called M1, M2, and M3. That was the data point that was most significant in everybody's mind. So they weren't looking at the unemployment numbers. They weren't looking at the payroll data. They weren't looking at the Fed meeting minutes, the kind of things that our attention is drawn to now. They were looking at the monetary aggregates. And that was important because we had just finished virtually a decade of a highly inflationary period. So inflation was on everyone's mind. And interestingly enough, we don't even look at that, at those numbers anymore. In fact, the Fed doesn't even report M3 anymore. It's a symptom of how things can change. But I would argue that those things are still important. And going back, you know, to the question of what I think is on my mind right now, it is the concept of what people, you know, how they view, for example, the dollar and how they view financial assets. And the disconnect, I think, for me is that people don't understand that a dollar is kind of an abstraction. In other words, it is not a static thing. Its value is really determined by what we think of its value. It doesn't have any intrinsic value in and of itself. But investors seem to treat it as if it is some kind of a constant. And if you are a person that believes in financial assets, which is the number one thing that investors or savers are stacking in their portfolio, in other words, this is the thing that we measure our wealth in. This is the thing that we are accumulating. This is the thing that we are fixated on. If you believe in financial assets, you have to understand that you are inextricably linked to the fate of the U.S. dollar. And that is the weakness and the weak point in the whole scheme of things right now. I believe that we are in a period in which you have to question what that value of the U.S. dollar is. And I would argue that what we think of as the value of the U.S. dollar is a number that is greatly overstated. And I could spend some time on that. But basically, you know, one of the things that motivated me to get back into the business was that I felt that that is something that people have not spent enough time considering. In other words, understanding where we came from, understanding the origin of our dollar, what gives it value, and so on, and understanding, most importantly, what happened in 1971 when the U.S. dollar was detached from something that was real, which was essentially the gold in which the dollar was exchangeable into. And when that was no longer the case in August of 1971, you began a set of circumstances that very much explain what happened and the world that we are in right now. I think that that's going to be the most important thing that will determine where we go from here. So we all know what happened in 2008. We had a debt crisis, and I would argue that that debt crisis was never actually fixed. We essentially saved the world by creating more debt and by printing lots of money to save the debt that had failed. And we're at that period right now where I think that we have the possibility of seeing another round of debt fail. And as investors, we have to consider what will be the response to that. And most importantly, we have to consider what has that all done to the value of the dollar. So for investors to believe in financial assets right now, Chris, you've got to basically believe that everything we did in, since 2008, which has been ongoing for the better part of, 8 or 9 years now, namely printing around the world something on the order of $12 trillion of new currencies. Whether it's the dollar, whether it's the yen, whether it's the euro, the combined aggregate amount of new money creation is something on the order of $12 trillion. We have also added almost 60% more debt to the total aggregate debt that existed in the world since 2008. So in order for you to believe in financial assets, you have to believe that we have printed all this new money, we have encumbered it with all this new debt, and somehow the unit value of that money has stayed the same. And that is a concept that I do not believe. And so my investment thesis revolves around not financial assets as a store of value, but real assets as a store of value. That investors need to examine what is in their portfolio and what is essentially the risk in the thing that they use as their store of value decaying in value. And I would argue that the dollar has already decayed in value from a fundamental point of view, but that has not been recognized from a perception point of view. So that creates the opportunity out there where we can exchange overvalued dollars for real assets that will perform better as a store of value going forward.
And I wonder, though, if you can give us more of maybe the subtle nuances behind this scenario you've outlined, because, frankly, we all agree with you. I mean, most of the listeners today, U.S. equities, very frothy, but, the trend remains very solid. And these themes tend to persist much longer than pundits believe they can. For instance, we have had an endless stream of people on this show for many years, since 2009, call the top. On this market, the carcasses of the bears litter the roadway. Also, the U.S. dollar, very strong uptrend, weakness in recent months. Just when do you think the tipping point will be reached? When will folks say, you know what, we've had enough of paper assets, the risk on trade, we're tired of that, let's move back to more solid assets? Give us an idea, please.
I think, Chris, we as investors are a rather impatient breed. So we look at, the timeline of the recent past, especially since 2008, and we say to ourselves, well, why hasn't this turned? Why hasn't the dollar turned? Why haven't equities turned? Why haven't certain things been recognized? When it comes to the dollar, I think that, the world was essentially caught by surprise and at some significant risk in terms of some dramatic change. In other words, where something like the dollar is used to settle an extraordinary amount of global trade, it's in everyone's interest not to have the apple cart upset overnight. So I believe that, you know, we've had rounds of coordinated intervention to keep markets in an orderly fashion. However, you know, 2008 represented a sneak preview of the vulnerability of our international financial system, and in particular, the vulnerability of the dollar. And so I think for everyone that is an actor on the world stage and on the global, you know, trade stage, et cetera, I think they looked at those circumstances and began to hedge their bets. And if you look at it from that point of view, extraordinary progress has been made to set our world up for alternatives to the dollar since 2008. So you had important actors like China, for example, going around to individual nations and opening up the door to settle bilateral trade using each other's currency other than the dollar. You had things like the Chinese setting up an alternate, you know, international development bank that would compete with something like the World Bank or the IMF to engage in development lending using a currency and a lending institution other than the IMF, other than the World Bank, which is a dollar-centric, U.S.-centric institution. And we now have this Chinese Development Bank, which has begun lending out money, and the assets and the lending that they do is not in U.S. dollars. And we've also even had the vulnerability to people understanding what happens politically if you get into the crosshairs of America in terms of a dispute politically, and how something like SWIFT, which is the world's most important money wiring system, can be used as a sanctioning tool against a country that is not perceived to be, you know, cooperating with U.S.-centric financial systems. So it was used against Iran. It was threatened to be used against other players. And those other players recognized that vulnerability, and they set up an entirely new money wiring system, which is called KIPS, and it's, you know, controlled by the Chinese. And those are not simple things to do. For example, that wiring system, which runs completely outside the U.S. financial system, actually employs undersea cables that crisscross the globe and touch all the major continents without ever interacting with a U.S. cable. So these are extraordinarily difficult and complex things to engineer, but I think it underlies the need for the rest of the world to move away from the dollar. If, in fact, if we look at how much trade is settled today in the U.S. dollar, I believe that number, Chris, right now is running something around 68%. That number in 2008 would have probably been in the high 80% range. So those are significant things. And the amount of trade that is settled in the Chinese currency, going back about 8 years, would have been in the small single-digit range, and that number today is climbing very rapidly, and it is about to breach through the 20% level. So these are actually extraordinary changes, and they act in a way where it removes the structural support for the U.S. dollar. In addition to that, the United States happens to be boxed into a situation, right or wrong, where it is boxed into a structural trade deficit and a structural budget deficit. So that means if you can visualize the U.S. economy, it is an entity which is emitting dollars to the rest of the world. And unless the rest of the world is willing and able on a voluntary basis to absorb the flow of that, you know, emission of dollars, if it doesn't do that, then those dollars begin to literally pile up, and it will begin to impact the unit value on a relative basis of those dollars. And I would argue, now that we've created this, you know, infrastructure away from the dollar, that the circumstances are set up for other people in the world to begin to settle trades in other currencies and to, more importantly, voluntarily choose to use another currency as the currency in which they store value or they store their surplus. And I think an investor who ignores that trend is ignoring that trend at their own peril. And I would also argue that the reason the dollar is overvalued is because it has been stored and used as a store of value by so many other players outside of the United States. If these dollars were to come home like lemmings coming back to the sea, that would be the event that would dramatically impact the U.S. markets. And the most important mechanism for that is literally to change the perceived rate of inflation. And the interesting thing is, investors have a misconception of what inflation is. They think that inflation is what happens when you go to the grocery store and you see that the price of things have gone up. I would argue that inflation, properly defined, is really the act of creating new dollars. And if you look at it in that way, the inflation that you need to create higher prices has already occurred. Those dollars have already been given birth. They exist in places outside of the United States. We have literally, as a nation, exported our inflation to other countries. And if these other countries make other plans, then literally you set yourself up for these dollars finding their way back home and creating the mechanism in which prices begin to change. And they could begin to change in a rather dramatic fashion, and that would have incredible consequences for financial assets, primarily through changes in interest rates. And I believe in a very subtle way, this has already occurred. It is already in the making. We're in that period, that inflection point, where investors are fighting yesterday's battle, in the sense that just as in the 1980s when I began in the business and people were looking at, you know, an inflationary environment that had taken place in the decade earlier, they did not see the set of circumstances that were going to lead to disinflation and lower interest rates on a secular basis, which is what created the boom in financial assets that continued through the last decade. In a 30-year plus, you know, extravaganza. I think the clock has turned, and now we're going to run that movie backwards. And it comes from interest rates having gone down from a very lofty level all the way to zero. And that zero was achieved through artificial means. We're now seeing interest rates very slowly going the other way, and I think it literally changes the whole picture for financial assets. It augurs the way into this set of circumstances that creates a different perception for the dollar and a different perception for things like inflation rates, which are critical for all investors, and that's where I think the opportunity is. The other set of assets, things like gold, for example, are not on people's radar screen because they don't understand how it fits into all of this. And it also happens to be very under-owned. If you look at things like gold as a percentage of wealth assets, I would argue that, you know, that number is an extraordinarily low number. Historically, it has been probably as much as 25 or 50 times the number that it is now as a share of private wealth. What has changed is that, you know, financial assets have taken the lion's share of people's wealth in terms of a percentage of that. And, you know, I think that that's the thing that's going to change. So our fund is very much geared towards real assets, and we are taking the position that financial assets represent lots of risk with very little return.
We certainly share your thoughts here at GoldSeek. We also concur that the 30-year bull market in bonds has likely peaked. We've seen certainly very large cracks in the foundation of the debt market. And initially, the U.S. equities sector has clearly benefited from it. But eventually, paper assets will wane. Obviously, investors just can't get enough of shares, despite these valuation levels, etc. Give us an idea of what might get folks to start considering the precious metals and other more solid asset classes.
Well, I think, Chris, you know, that is the number one question, you know, in all of our minds. In other words, you know, what are the catalysts? What is the timing? What are the things to watch? What are the signposts? And I think it all comes back down to the dollar. So it happens to be the thing that I am most closely watching every day for signs that these type of changes are imminent. They are being transmitted into the system. You know, we don't live in a world where we can impose our will on the rest of the world. We might have been in that kind of world a long, long time ago, but we're not in that world. So the rest of the world, they get a vote in how all this plays out. We cannot force them to hold our dollars. And yet, structurally speaking, we're in a situation where our economy depends upon constant emission of new dollars. In fact, the story that I like to give people is, if you were someone on planet Mars and you were studying the world economy on planet Earth, you know, using a telescope and some kind of a sound listening device, I think what you would report back is that there are a bunch of different countries, and they all seem to do different things, they make different things, and they trade different things from one another. But every other country in the world, their income is derived upon what they sell versus what they buy to the rest of the world. In other words, their income is a function of how much more they sell than what they consume. The difference in terms of surplus is what they get to spend on something else. There is only one country on planet Earth that doesn't operate on that matrix, and that country is the United States. The United States gets to consume much more than they produce, and the reason is the United States has had the benefit of owning and controlling the currency that the rest of the world has used for a very long time as a so-called reserve currency. A reserve currency means that is the currency that the world's producers and savers, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like China, that produce much more than they consume, they need to basically, you know, stack up something. And what they've always chosen as their premier, you know, currency of choice to save in, the United States dollar. So if that were not the case, then the United States wouldn't be able to get away with, a circumstance in which they got to enjoy more of the world's resources and goods than they actually earned from, you know, selling things to the rest of the world. So the thing that I think is going to identify a change in all of these circumstances is going to be the value of the U.S. dollar around the world. In other words, what something like the DXY is. The DXY is a common index that we use to measure the U.S. dollar against a basket of other currencies. In the last couple of days, that number has been, you know, weakening considerably. It is somewhere around, you know, 97 and change on the DXY index. The low has been something in the with a 70 handle that was briefly touched in that period of during the financial crisis. That number happens to be a very leveraged number against other assets. So, for example, I would argue that if we were to see a sudden weakening of the dollar on the DXY index, it would have a leveraged effect on gold prices. In fact, when gold was making its so-called high in September of 2011, the dollar index was considerably lower than where it is now. And the effect on the gold price when the dollar strengthened was essentially taking gold from a high of, you know, call it 1900, down to a low of, call it 1100, which was a rather dramatic price change in relation to the dollar going from high 70s to a number that was around, let's say, 103, 104 on the DXY index. A reversal of that trend, I believe, would have, you know, dramatic impacts on not only the gold market, but on other commodities, the thing that I would call, you know, real things, real assets. So I'm watching very carefully what the value of the dollar is on the DXY as a kind of an early warning system in terms of whether this scenario is happening. And if other people around the world are choosing to de-emphasize the dollar as the reserve currency or the thing that they are saving in, it's going to translate in that index, and it's going to have a dramatic impact on the United States because we won't be throttling back, Chris, our emission of U.S. dollars just because the rest of the world has had enough of it. We're structurally locked in to these budget deficits and trade deficits. So if the dollar begins to basically pile up around the world, it's going to show up as a difference in its value, and that in turn will show up in terms of higher interest rates and higher inflation rates in the United States, which will have an enormous impact on the financial assets at a time when investors in general are not expecting that. You know, if you look at how bonds are priced, they are not taking into account the possibility of higher rates of inflation. So that would drive big changes in prices if it were to materialize, and it would drive, you know, great opportunities in terms of things that are not priced in.
John Scorsese, any other parting comments for our listeners today?
You know, I just want to say that I think we are very fortunate to be alive in a very historic time. You know, we saw something that never had happened in the history of 5,000 years of monetary history. And by that, I refer to zero interest rates.
Or negative interest rates, all right? 3.75% at the People's Bank of China. Talk about historic. I don't think the founders of this nation could have even comprehended the implications of solidly negative interest rates.
That literally, Chris, has never happened. And that is a history that goes back 5,000 years. So it basically proves the point that we are living in an historic moment in time. And just to go back to what I said when I started out in the business in 1981, that period in which the U.S. long bond traded, the 30-year bond, traded at a near 15% yield. And that was an opportunity of a lifetime. In fact, I remember the head government bond trader at Morgan Stanley. I was a young recruit sitting on that desk as a trainee. I remember that particular fellow who was a very nice gentleman. Unfortunately, he passed away, you know, on 9/11. He was a senior guy at Cantor Fitzgerald in 9/11. But he had the sensibility of understanding that that was a extremely important period of time. And he took that opportunity to do something that I think very few people would have done, which is, he gave up a very promising career. He was the head trader of the government bond desk at Morgan Stanley. And he gave up his career and went out and raised privately a pool of funds where the express purpose was to buy as much of that 30-year bond as he could get his hands on. Back in those days, it was possible to leverage on a 10-to-1 basis something like a government bond asset. So he left his career. He raised this money. Back then, by the way, I would remind people, the term hedge fund had not been invented yet. What he did was essentially that, but just through family and friends, he raised a number that was probably around $10 million or so, and then he went and bought $100 million of the U.S. long bond, and the rest was history. People didn't see that. Most people didn't see that. When you're at that inflection point where the tide turns, people generally don't get it, and it sometimes takes years before that perception changes, and by the time it does change, the financial landscape has been completely altered. Chris, we are at that kind of inflection point, similarly to what happened, you know, nearly 40 years ago. The tide has shifted, and when that tide shifts this time, it's going to shift away from financial assets, and it's easy to see why and how. The only thing it takes is for interest rates to go up. And again, I would bring your listeners back into the whole issue of the dollar and whether or not the dollar's value is a static instrument. The thing that I think most people should be thinking about is the question of how can you create more and more and more new dollars, encumber those dollars with more and more and more debt, and somehow you're supposed to believe that the dollar is still worth the same, having done all that, as it was before you started doing all that. I don't believe that's possible, Chris. I just don't believe that. So I'm operating on an assumption that our dollar is overvalued, that investors have ascribed a value on that dollar that is yesterday's battle, yesterday's perception, and the only thing that has to follow now is people's perception. And when they do follow, it will be like, you know, a remaking of the financial landscape, and it will be a shift away from financial assets, and it will dramatically impact the prices of things that we have become used to. And that's where I think the great opportunity lies.
And my guess is you've put some considerable thought into the different avenues and sectors and ways for folks with different backgrounds to benefit from the precious metals. Please tell us more.
Well, I think, Chris, that, you know, the most exciting thing about, you know, the precious metals, and in particular gold, physical gold, is that, number one, it is under-owned. Number two, I believe it is mispriced. And number three, it carries all of the attributes that represent an antidote to the three major risks that an investor faces today. Number one, the risk of debasement. So while you have the world central banks on a campaign of creating an enormous amount of new money, quote unquote, and I believe that that rate of money creation around the world has been proceeding at something like $200 billion per month since 2008. We are seeing the world's money, that what we know of as money, being debased on a constant basis. An investor has to recognize that as a real investment risk. The other risk that investors face is obviously credit risk. It was a credit problem that emerged in 2008 and brought the world's financial system to its knees. What we've done since then is literally combated that problem by creating more debt. So the world hasn't fixed anything. You don't create a solution to a debt problem by creating more debt. So credit is an important risk. Gold, not being a debt instrument, has no credit risk. And then the third thing that we all have to be aware of as investors is the issue of counterparty risk. Physical gold does not represent anyone's counterparty risk because no one needs to perform a promise on that asset in order for that asset to hold its value. So Gold has a place in everyone's portfolio simply because of those three attributes. And in addition to that, you know, I believe it happens to be greatly mispriced, because if you look at the stack of wealth instruments that people, you know, can identify, whether they are sovereign bonds, whether they are, you know, equities, if you look at the aggregate sizes of all sovereign debt, of all, you know, world equities, they are dwarfed. Physical gold is dwarfed by those other things. And I would argue that gold as a wealth reserve is one of the most important of all of our, you know, wealth assets. Maybe the most important one, because, you know, if you study monetary history, it's kind of like the chicken and egg question. What came first? Was it money or gold? Or was it gold that gave money its value from the beginning? So I think a lot of the keys to the future, Chris, are held in the past. And we need to study what has happened in the past, where we have come from, to get the answers to where we are going. And I don't want to say all roads point to gold, but it certainly points to a higher role for gold as a wealth reserve than what people give it credit for. And it, you know, given the fact that it doesn't have those risk attributes that virtually every other financial asset wealth reserve has or currency has, it becomes even more important and something that is very worthy of examination. And that these currencies are overvalued and that our debt is problematic, you have to ask yourself, how do we get out of this problem? In other words, in order for us to really solve a debt problem, we have to basically deal with the debt. We know that default is not an option. I mean, the country of Greece was not allowed to default on their debt. When we had a large default in subprime bonds, for example, in 2008, the financial world was brought to its knees, and we had to end up saving that debt failure. So default is not part of the solution. Debasing the money by printing all the money you need to satisfy the debt, if you go that route, then I think it's easy to see that the money will have no value. So where does it leave you? And, you know, you brought up, Chris, the point of these cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, like Bitcoin, etc. We cannot forget the very important fact that gold is a monetary asset that sits on the balance sheet of every major central bank. They are the people that are going to control and decide the outcome of where we go. And I would argue that what is on that asset balance sheet is going to figure into what they need to do. And historically, debt crises have been met by simply revaluing gold, which is another way of saying you devalue your currency. So without going into a whole lot of detail, because it's a subject in and of itself, when people look at the price of gold, it's interesting that they look at it in terms of dollars. But if you believe that the, you know, gold goes down, for example, what you're really saying is that the dollar has to go up. Another way of looking at the price of anything is looking at it in terms of, you know, the number of ounces of gold that an asset or a thing represents. So we can basically deal with our debt problem by taking that asset that sits on the balance sheet of the world central banks and revaluing it. And you can revalue it to a number that basically powers over all the debt we've managed to accumulate. So gold could hold the key to how we solve the world's debt problem. And that key basically means that we are going to devalue the world's currencies. And that becomes a possibility, a very real possibility, that figures in a huge way to the future of all financial assets and the future to interest rates, etc. And it is not a scenario that is priced into gold.
You brought up this idea of parity with gold and U.S. equities in the early 80s. History doesn't always repeat itself, but it has a tendency to rhyme. There are examples in, let's say, modern history, shares market skyrocket in union, if you will, with the precious metals market. We saw that in the Weimar Republic and again in Zimbabwe, and we've seen this in more recent times in Venezuela. Could we see equities skyrocket along with the precious metals?
When it comes to how equities are denominated in dollars, depending on what happens to the dollar, you can, you know, make the price of anything in dollars, whatever it's going to be, depending on what happens to the U.S. dollar. But I would argue when it comes to that, you know, one-to-one parity between gold and equities, for example, which certainly happened in the early 80s, could it happen again? And why hasn't it happened again? One has to also look at what we think of as the gold market. And the problem with how we look at gold is that we look at gold as if it's one thing. And the reality is, our so-called gold market happens to be adulterated by, you know, copious amounts of paper gold, which are nothing more than a financial instrument. So if you look at the actual amount of, for example, gold that trades as a foreign currency hedge, in other words, the XAU, for example, the amount of gold that changes hands on the currency desks around the world, where people use it to hedge currency positions and so on. I remember seeing numbers recently that said that the daily volume was something like $500 billion a day, which actually is kind of a low number when you consider what the volumes of currency turnover, like, for example, the British pound or the volume of those transactions. So, but the point is, $500 billion a day, the world's mining output is a small fraction of that per annum. So there's no way that $500 billion of physical gold is changing hands every day. What's changing hands are gold-colored pieces of paper that are denominated in ounces of gold, but have no gold collateral behind them. They are merely financial instruments. If you were to take away paper gold and say, you know, we're going to have a market of gold, but it's only physical gold, then what would be the value of that gold if it were to be required, physical gold was to be required to meet the demand that investors have for gold as an asset? And I would argue it would already be one-to-one with the equities market. Now, what would it take for that to happen? You would need to have some kind of a default in the paper gold market. We haven't seen that happen, but it goes hand in hand with the possibility of default in other paper instruments or debt instruments, which paper gold has to be viewed, of course, as a debt instrument. It's not physical gold. I mean, all the reasons an investor should hold gold would steer them away from holding paper gold. Because if you hold paper gold, you are not getting prevention of credit risk. You are not getting the prevention of counterparty risk. And I would argue you're not getting the prevention of debasement risk. So what is that paper anyway? The remarkable thing of our time, this historic time, is that investors haven't even bothered, Chris, to make the distinction between paper gold and physical gold. So if you go to the so-called gold store, there's two tellers. One sells actual bricks of gold that come out the window, and the other teller is pushing out pieces of gold-colored paper that are denominated in ounces. They trade at the same price. And I find that to be remarkable, because in the world of, for example, municipal bonds, for example, we pay attention to things like collateral. So things that have more collateral behind them are priced differently. But apparently, paper gold that has no collateral is priced the same as physical gold. I would love to have someone explain that.
It seems to me as though the scenario you're painting for us here today is rather ominous, because what keeps popping into my mind, another 2008-like crisis, you know, at that time it was mortgage-backed securities, and investors were frantically searching for the balance sheets and where have they hidden these weapons of financial mass destruction. Anyone who figured that out early made absolute fortunes if they purchased the credit default swaps and whatnot. But the real key here, as we look forward, what is encumbered? Where is the debt? What is real? What is tangible versus paper promises? All right, John Scorsese, I wonder if you could tell people more, please, about Corona Associates Capital Management and just what they'll find at your website.
Well, thank you, Chris. It has been a real pleasure. And for anyone that is interested in what we are doing, I would encourage them to visit our website, which is www.coronacap.com.
We'll look forward to having you back on Goldseek.
This has been a real pleasure for me, and I hope to have another chance to dialogue with you again.
Peter Grandich from Peter Grandich & Company rejoins the show, Wall Street analyst. Welcome back, Peter Grandich.
Glad to be here, Chris.
Every time some major pundit, I think one of the latest was Mr. Stockman, says, you know, the end is nigh, things have just gotten too frothy, extended valuations, earnings just not sustainable to keep the bull on Wall Street running. But we start making new highs. Do you see anything different this time around?
Kind of in a sideways move these last few months. I know the NASDAQ has done a little bit better, and I think that's because at the tail end of a bull run, the more speculative things kind of tend to do better, as people have really milked the blue chips for all they could get. So I don't know. I've never been in that we're going to have a crash, but I do think we're going to go into a much more difficult period. I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical. I think what you have to ask yourself now is first build a stock portfolio at these valuations. And problems I always heard for a third of a century being around Wall Street was financial advisors tell you when to buy, but they don't tell you when to sell. Well, I think one of the first times you got to think about selling is when you wouldn't first start buying today, and I'm in that camp. So I guess for me anyway, I would not want to be have any really general equity portfolio going forward. I don't know if Stockmans of the world be right and there'll be, you know, 50 or 60% decline. But I think, A, there's going to be a period of, you know, much difficult times, and I think there's alternatives. And, of course, obviously one that I've put most of my hard-earned dollars in this last year or so, and that's things related to gold.
You're really echoing the sentiments so many of our guests on the show. They're very concerned by disingenuous government policies. Obviously, we are going to see another rate hike if we can believe the Fed funds futures here. Policymakers are ready to slow economic growth. They see signs of overheating. We have, according to one of their latest reports at the Fed, 44% of Americans have less than $400 in savings. Approaching 100 million people have less than $400 in savings. And the majority of working age folks are living from paycheck to paycheck. It's just the norm now. Why are these numbers bifurcated?
The bulk of my business is in planning, estate planning, retirement, and then with early. My absolute biggest concern by far that you hear, not so much from the clients that we end up seeing, but just generally in the marketplace, and that is, people are fearful they won't have enough assets for their retirement. And part of that reason is because, like you said, is people have not been, there have been statistics now that have come out in the last year that show that people are about where they were 10 or 20 years ago, but we all know that things cost more. I mean, I just don't even look at the inflation numbers, Chris. I mean, anybody thinks that inflation, if the net expenses to live is only been 1% or 2%, each year for the last 20 years, then things have been a lot more expensive than what's reported as. The other concern that you have to have in that is that the expectation of those people that you spoke about are going to be for the government to help them. I mean, and it's different here than we haven't seen in Greece or to the world when people found themselves up and the government really has gone to a level that, you know, it really can't go more. Where else do you tap from? So I think that there's going to, like, again, that's part of a long list of reasons why I am not very optimistic for the financial markets going out, and why I also think that you have to start looking at things where there isn't any question of overvalueness. And one of the few areas that fits that criteria is the gold market.
I'd like to tie in an article last night, cryptocurrencies. Some in the gold crowd have been put off by the fact that there are huge money flows pouring into, I'm sure you know, Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum. And this trend has really gained steam. For instance, $100 invested in Bitcoin around 2011 is now a multi-million dollar investment. People are rummaging through laptops and old computer hard drives, you know, looking for a gold mine today that they just tossed. The foundation of the cryptocurrency world, of course, is the blockchain. We know there are some potential backdoors, zero days, and threats involved there, which could make people question the safety of this digital unbacked currency. That just improves the odds, or at least the appeal, of the precious metals.
I think you did a very good job there. It's funny you say that, because last night I was out at a local minor league baseball game, and no fewer than three people, including one of the people working there, was talking about not so much Bitcoin, but a rather new one that was touted in the local area. And it brought me back, and I sat down to a person and said, this reminded me back of the late 90s when people were talking about, you know, their neighbors were opening up internet-based companies. And, well, we all know what happened there. I like history, and gold has history. It has a couple thousand years going for it, and I'm not to say that these digital currencies don't have value, but, you know, when you start having, you know, new ones each day, you know, there's only so much speculative money that can fly around, and then eventually there's too much supply and not enough demand, and I don't think gold faces that problem. And so for me, and Chris, you know, for your listeners who don't know me, I don't sell anything about gold. I don't represent mining companies. I don't have log cabins or dry food or anything to sell to paint a negative picture. I look at gold for myself strictly as a capital gains opportunity right now. I've not been this comfortable in gold since maybe the late 1980s to early 90s when it really got cheap to me compared to other valuations. And I just like the way it's trading. I'm very, very content to sit here and have a slow rising. And I put up on our blog about a week ago what I call a perfect three-step rise, where gold is making a series of higher highs and higher lows. Yes, not big spreads between them, but nevertheless, and that's the best type of formation in the early days of a bull market, which I think gold is in. So, yes, I, you know, these currency other things could run and all, but I'm being conservative, and I'm quite comfortable owning gold here and things related to it.
You sparked a memory. Just read a profound article written by the proprietor of the Economic Collapse blog site. His name is Michael Schneider. He's in the media now pretty regularly and other things, kind of moving up the ladder there. He went back to the Great Depression and the years that led up to the Great Depression, and he analyzed the GDP in recent years. Our latest reading, I think it was like 0.7, just anemic numbers. He looked at the numbers leading up to the Great Depression of GDP, and of course, they swung much more wildly. But it averaged out to the 10 years before the Great Depression of 1.33% growth. Well, he just ran the numbers on the last 10 years, and it was exactly 1.33 growth.
I think the big thing that's lost in the general financial media regarding economic growth is how much did we pay for it? And what I mean by that is during the Obama administration, the amount of debt that the government took on supposedly fund its needs and to service, you know, America and what have you for all the things that whatever it did just grew by enormous amounts. And yet, how much of a bang did we get for that? Because that's a debt now. You know, that money can't be kind of reused again. It was shot, and now what do we get for it? We, like you said, we've had anemic growth. You know, we made it harder to take on more debt because there's only a point to where, you know, not only does the principal start to be concerned about being serviced, but, you know, the actual interest payments. And that's an argument in itself that if interest rates rise too far, that we can have trouble in that. And so I just think that there's been a narrow band of people who have participated, the 1%, the 5%, whatever you want to call it. The vast majority of people have not. The absolute hatred, I mean, that's the only way I can describe it, between people, whether it's Democrats, Republicans, left, right, whatever it is, there's no middle ground anymore. And there's absolutely, I was talking to somebody who actually makes a living as a lobbyist last night in Washington, an older man. He's been there for 40 years, and it was his words, not mine. He said, things have not only grinded to a halt in Washington, they're in reverse. And so, you know, you can't expect any real fiscal policy or any other type of things to be done in Washington. The Democrats are using just everything they can throw at Trump in order to hopefully win back Congress. I mean, it just, there's no bipartisanship at all. And without that, I just don't see the enormous problems that are out there being fixed. And again, I'm not a fatalist. I think I'm a realist. And, I I'm not loading up on dry food or have a cabin somewhere, but I really think things are going to be much tougher and, far tougher for my children and if I have grandchildren than it was for me. This is not something that's going to go away in an economic cycle or maybe even a decade. It may take, a lifetime or more of our younger children, even if things started to be worked on it now, to fix the problems after seven decades that have been building up.
On the one hand, this is a war of attrition. That is really what all the major themes indicate. Go back to history a third time, and we see, you know, the decline of the British Empire, which the sun never set on the British Empire. Unfortunately, I think that parallels what we're seeing here in the United States, and both my grandmothers were daughters of the American Revolution. There's two parts to this story. Last week, we saw unemployment numbers tumble to a 28.5-year low. How do we explain this discrepancy?
Well, first of all, Chris, the quality of jobs and the amount of people who are working multiple jobs for less money and the people who have literally given up is not really reflected in the way that those numbers are shown. In fact, John Quidel, who's probably one of the only two or three financial journalists that I actively look forward to hearing what he has to say, he's been a writer for the New York Post for a long time, has spoken out loud for almost no one to listen, that we are in that April, May, June period where the government does this absolute phantom amount of assumptions of job creation that is only assumed with a pencil and a pad, not by any realistic research. It's called seasonal factors. And what inevitably happens later in the year, they get revised down. So I would caution your listeners, including with this June month coming out, that certainly things are better than the financial crisis, but A, the jobs that are being created versus the ones that were 10 or 20 years ago. That's why the economic growth is weak, because there's no real high-paying, high-income earners, and like you said, so few people, after they pay the simplest things just to stay alive, have no discretionary income, go out and do things that used to help grow the economy. So, like I said, I'm not saying that they're sitting in a room somewhere in Washington and this is one big scam, but there is a lot of things that below the surface, and if people who are too busy in life trying to stay afloat could take the time to look at, I think they would be much more concerned, and you and I both know it's very hard to find those real facts in what we would call the general mainstream media these days. We really only learn of those things from, thankfully, one of the good things that came out of the internet was an alternative to mainstream media that can operate in cyberspace and not on the major networks.
We're obviously both gold bugs, and in that realm, it tends to draw a level of pessimism because the precious metals are so negatively correlated with the typical asset classes ranging from bonds, but in particular stocks. When one zigs, the other zags, and we tend to favor volatility. But I'm a natural optimist, and I want to believe that this talk of big corporate tax reforms, as well as the potential to expand our economy through all types of new programs, might just have the stimulative effect on economic output that we're all hoping for. What are the numbers telling you? Will we see a revival in the United States, or will these lackluster growth numbers become the new norm?
Well, Chris, first of all, history will show that I've been both out of the gold market and actually bearish on gold. While it's true that a fair bit of time I've been quite bullish on it. As I stated earlier when we started, I'm not long goal now because I think the world is ending or anything of that nature. I'm long because I believe it's certainly undervalued compared to financial assets. And I believe there are a series of events that are brewing that can only make it propel it higher. And if that was the same for stocks or bonds, I'd be long them instead. I think the economy is just, it's just not going to ever look. We've heard for almost 10 years that we were in a recovery and eventually we're going to have expansion. And the expansion never comes because it can't come. The economy is too bared down by debt. It's too brought down by a number of funding issues on the state and local level that are becoming acute, from pensions to all sorts of factors. In fact, I wrote most recently, and I don't know if you've spoken about it recently to other guests, but there's a bill floating in Congress now to, in a sense, allow about $1 trillion of student debt to just float into bankruptcy and to, in a sense, not make good on that. Now, what about the people that was owed to? That was owed to the government. The government's us. Okay, so that was eventually money that was to be paid back that would have been used for other things, and now if you wipe that off, the government has to come up with another way to pay for the things it still has to pay for. But I also think it sets a precedent that people can just say, you know what, if you owe the money, if you fight long enough and don't pay it, they'll wipe it away. And it just sets up issues that debtors, I think, can use in their favor. But again, it goes to the level of that much of the problems that we have in America. You see, when I was a young man, we were the world's largest creditor nation. Now we're the largest debtor nation. And through history, particularly, if I may, from biblical, for those who care to believe that the Bible is not only a historic book, it's a book about faith and what used to make up the bulk of this country, a Judeo-Christian society. And that is that there's not a positive verse in all of it that supports debt and the warnings of what debt leads to. And I just think we're just on the threshold of seeing that. So I just don't see how the economy can have any great expansion. Yes, there's a small and it's a narrow and it's a the top of a pyramid group who do well in this, but by and large, most aren't. And eventually, when that separation comes too great, the bulk of the people are overwhelmed and want to take back from that small group. And that small group will not have enough islands or arms or people to hire to protect itself if the masses ever get to that extreme. Now, I don't see blood in the streets anytime soon, but I do think people will become extremely frustrated, and that can only go on for so long before that frustration goes to another level.
Peter Grand, it's just a pleasure hearing your thoughts. We will have all of your contact info online.
Thank you.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. A CNN article entitled "Trump's Budget by the Numbers: What Gets Cut and Why" caught my attention this week. It provided a selective insight into proposed administration budget cuts and their justifications. While the emphasis of the article appeared to simply try and underscore all the areas that could potentially be cut, like science, research, the arts, and social welfare programs, along with politically charged new administration initiatives like increased defense spending and a border wall, the real story was buried not in the article, but in the budget itself. Fortunately, there was a link to the 159-page document called "Major Savings and Reforms, Budget of the U.S. Government, Fiscal Year 2018. It was a long read. I went through several cups of coffee absorbing it. If you don't take the time to read it yourself, I suggest at least reading the table of contents to fully appreciate the myriad of programs that are up for grabs financially. One theme that emerged throughout the budget is the notion of giving states more authority and freedom to make choices at a local level. The premise often sounds good in political stump speeches, but in practice, it means cost shifting onto the backs of already financially weakened states. It means more taxes at a state level if certain programs are shifted back and retained. But if they are not retained, it means the states get to make the ultimately unpopular political choices that the federal government would rather not make and simply disguise as more freedom and autonomy for the states. It's a clever argument and tactic for passing the baton of political hard choices. The justification for eliminating a variety of home assistance loans and products is that financial markets have become more efficient and increased the reach of mortgage credit to lower credit qualities and incomes. Therefore, utilizing the private banking industry to provide this service with a guarantee from the federal government is a more efficient way to deliver this assistance, so says the budget. Anyone listening to this show for the past decade will clearly understand why I strongly disagree with the notion that our financial markets have become more efficient. Quite the contrary. Market interventions, both overt and surreptitious, have created significantly mispriced risk, debt and asset allocation, and new stock market and housing bubbles. The illusion of efficiency may be visible now, but the magic mirrors creating that illusion are about to be shattered by the tuning forks of truth as political, financial, and media-driven agendas change merely by the fact of being observed for what they really are. The mere act of simply observing these traditionally top-down influencers from the bottom up will change their very essence over time. The resistance will be fierce, as you can see for yourself when you watch just about anything in mainstream media. When traditional, political, financial, and media thought leaders are uprooted and displaced by new, innovative thought leaders, processes, and truth, the pushback is chaotic. The fact that their deeds, ideologies, and motives have already been observed has already changed everything. It may simply take a while for reality to catch up with this process. When you read the justifications for enacting one budget cutback, expansion, or the shifting of responsibilities back onto individual states, you realize that yes, some things will be cut. But you also realize that this is just another game of political football, with a new coach, new players, a new stadium, and a very upset fan base, regardless of team affiliation. Because lurking outside that stadium is a debt-based monetary system financed by near 0% interest rates, a system that will gobble up any offsetting cuts with higher interest rates. Because when someone dares to ask, what are we going to do with all the money we, quote, save from these cuts? The answer is that over time, we are going to pay it in the form of higher interest rates and a corresponding reduction in our standard of living. But don't worry. On page 147 of the budget is the authority for the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to construct a new facility, so that no doubt we can and will print the difference. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.